So Some indicate that's just not the case. Several Rockets and Canadians, another study completely omitted any reference to any dynamics. And so, and that's the trouble with some of these empirical studies, you have to look and see what was the testing group that they used in the two studies that were referred to by the defense in this case. They didn't even test women to see if the phraseology was understood by women. And in this case, we have, of course, an audience of Wisconsinites and, you know, a general population. So whatever standard we use has to be understandable to the total target audience.
Counsel, let me, for argument's sake, say you're right. It's confusing. And I look at Judge Brown's concurring opinion, and on page 9 of the split opinion, he says, I would be the first to say that not all jurors would believe this is meaning of the instruction, but I argue that some would. And that, in part, summarizes several pages of discussion that is confusing to different people, regardless of what the studies make, and different people can interpret it differently. So that's what I'll give you back. Or how do you make the next leap, which you must make in order to prevail? I look at 85.18.2, which is the statute that indicates that no judgment shall be reversed or set aside or no trial granted unless it shall appear that the error rendered has affected a substantial rights of the party seeking to reverse or set aside the judgment or to secure the trial. It seems to me that the most you can show is, look, this is confusing. I don't know how it affected this trial. How about you and I able to show to this court that I cannot avoid confusing instruction, confuse this jury by resulting in the error affecting your substantial rights? How do you make that leap different? What argument or evidence do you have? First thing you pointed out to the judge is that the trial judge said there was some merit in our argument. Secondly, you might indicate that in the course of the closing argument, record 4150-5156, there were three references by defense counsel in closing argument to the burden of proof. Actually, established that the greater weight, certainly there was ample evidence in this case, that the testimony in this case was the cause of this particular injury was injection. There was no contrary evidence, that is to say, there was no defense expert that came in and said that the cause was something else. Instead, there was some speculation as to what it could be. It could be a fluid, it could be that the injection. Didn't come out and say directly what the cause of the injury was, or whether it may be injured. As far as you are concerned, I'm sure it was for us to take away, and they can raise other inferences. We may not go out the way, that's true. But I think that if you look at the totality of the circumstances here, there was a close case, and there were two jurors that dissented in that particular instruction. And I think that we can establish this was not an academic issue. This was, again, an issue that we raised in court. This is the case where the court approved. You can see this is a correct statement of the law, however. You can see that the phrase to a reasonable certainty by the greater weight of the credible evidence is not an accurate, albeit confusing statement.
I believe that that accurate statement, but
virtue of the fact that the real burden of proof is two standards, burden of producing evidence so that we can get beyond a motion to dismiss before the circuit judge, and a burden of persuasion. That burden of persuasion standard is by the preponderance of evidence. As soon as you just depose the standard reasonable certainty next to the standard preponderance of evidence, you have confusion. We would submit to the court that those are two separate standards. The preponderance of evidence standard is the lowest standard, which is the proper standard in this particular civil case, in all cases, including business cases. Evidence is meant evidence which, when weighed against evidence opposed to it, has more convincing power. Credible evidence is evidence which, in light of reason and common sense, is worthy of their belief. A party contending that the answer to a question should be yes is accountable to prove by the greater weight of the evidence, credible evidence.
With an audience, a general audience, ability to address to.
It's most likely not going to be audience that has professional degrees. And experience has shown that those people who graduate, for example, from college, the reading level is a little bit less than that. Those people who graduate from high school, the reading level is a little bit less than that over time. And so if we keep our instructions simple and clear, more likely they're going to be able to function as they're expected to do. Well, we suggest that the burden of proof jury instruction is a product of a historical accident. The modern trend in the law is to make the law comprehensible. As I said, insurance policies are to be readable. Court records, according to your court rule, are to be readable. More legislation defines terms before the operative provisions for clarity so that the reader can understand what you're presenting. Jury instructions should do so also. The language evolves over time and so does the usage. If you look at the old cases that we have in Wisconsin, they didn't link the terms reasonable certainty to greater weight of the evidence. That came in only after the Judicial Committee in 1970s issued a boilerplate. The current jury instruction is confusing and misleads the jury into the notion that the standard to prove the civil case is greater than it truly is. The lowest standard is what we're dealing with here, not the middle standard. Respondents' references to the Keene case are misplaced because the Keene case refers to the middle burden of standard.
Finally, we are suggesting that
in this case, the defense referred to the burden of closing arguments, but the issue was reinforced in the jury's mind.
Nurse Buggy, in this case, testified that in her experience, the nerve can be hit directly by a needle, which should be supportive of our case. No opinion was given by her on cause. Dr. Terry opined that it was rather unlikely to develop the condition spontaneously. That's record at 40.148. He testified that he's not familiar with the nurse's standard of care, but if a nurse gave an injection within the standard of care, it could result in an injury. The stated record shows that there was one doctor who expressed a cause opinion and no doctor contravened. We feel that in this particular case, we've established that we were prejudiced by virtue of that testimony. Also, I would also indicate to the court that this new change would be consistent with the Pucci case, in which the court basically said that a doctor can testify to a reasonable probability and it wasn't required that he testify to reasonable certainty. So we have a kind of a dichotomy in our law in which we permit the experts to testify to reasonable probability, but we insist that the jury somehow come to an understanding between what reasonable certainty is and what the greater weight of evidence is.
Whether it's a reasonable likelihood or a reasonable certainty or a reasonable probability or a reasonable more likely than not, let me advance the argument that all of that is akin to gobbledygook, and that you might be better off adopting the approach that you have in some of your appendix, that is, that, to paraphrase then 200 burden of proof, the burden of proof on question blank rests on the party contending that the answer to a question should be yes, to convince you by the greater weight of the credible evidence, and forget to convince you by a reasonable probability by the greater weight of the evidence, or to convince you and forget about to a reasonable certainty or a reasonable likelihood, and just to convince you by the greater weight of the credible evidence. I noticed that that's something that appears in your appendix, that kind of that is utilized in other jurisdictions. Why aren't you advancing that? And why isn't your to a reasonable probability just substituting potential confusion?
Judge, I like your phraseology better than the other phraseology, and I think it's clearer. And it's just the question of how far you're going to go along the line of this particular drafting. We initially submitted a very brief change just to raise the issue in trial court, knowing that the trial court would probably stick to the boilerplate and we'd have to be up here in the first place. If I was drafting it, I certainly would delete the phrase to reasonable probability as well and just make it as clear and concise as possible, because the longer the sentence, the more difficult the juror has in comprehending it.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Would reasonable certainty be retained in any kind of civil case?
No, Judge. I would not recommend that, because, as I indicated, the jurisprudence in the United States doesn't link that phrase with the preponderance rule, and it leads to confusion. I would suggest you to delete that.
So what would you do with clear and convincing evidence? That burden,
it can stay there, but the phraseology to a reasonable certainty should be, I suggest, deleted, because of the same problem. It makes things confusing. We have businessmen that have to go before a jury, and they want to prove their antitrust case, or they have commercial lease cases. They stand fraught with the same problem, that is, that they're not sure that the juries are going out in this issue lawless, because they don't understand what the burden truly is. If they feel that the burden is greater than the middle standard by virtue of that phraseology, then I think we don't have justice. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Stone? Okay. Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Nelson, representing the American Continental Insurance Company et al.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm John Nelson. I represent St. Mary's Medical Center, Inc., an American Continental Insurance Company. We submit that the decisions of the trial court and the Court of Appeals should be correctly affirmed for a number of reasons, including that Judge Krull gave the standard jury instruction in full compliance with Instruction 200 on burden of proof, that the standard jury instruction is an accurate statement of the law and incorporates decisions of this court for over 100 years. Number three, that the appellant has conceded that the standard instruction set forth current Wisconsin law on the subject. Number four, that the appellant's proposed change to this instruction by adding probability instead of certainty was specifically held to be error by this court in a prior decision. Number five, that the standard jury instruction is in conformity with the law as determined by the jury instruction committee, who also noted in their notes that the rephrasing of probability, replacing certainty, would not be appropriate. And lastly, appellant has not alleged or argued that any alleged error affected the plaintiff's substantial rights. I wanted to mention that I believe it's clear that that the Court of Appeals unanimously affirmed the trial court's the issues on appeal before the appellate court. I do not believe that anyone can read into Judge Brown's concurrence any challenge to the propriety of the judgment or the giving of that instruction by the trial court. And Judge Brown's suggestion that the court review the wording of the burden of proof instruction presumably would be for prospective application only.
If this were for, let's say you win, let's say, assuming arguendo, so what do you really think about the jury instruction? Is it confusing?
I have looked at the Supreme Court cases, Your Honor, and I think at some point there has to be a standard set. Is it confusing? I'd like to think not, but anytime you use a word, I think a number of people could look at and view it differently.
Judge, I read earlier an excerpt from page 9 of the slip opinion of Judge Brown's concurring opinion, where he said, you know, I grant you that some people might see it this way, and he is advancing. I see it a different way. That's loosely paraphrasing it. He said, but I'd be the first to grant you that some people wouldn't see it the way that I do.
Well,
does that capture the way you see it, or do you see it differently?
Well, I think, in all fairness, no matter what burden or standard we use, it can never be defined as explicitly so that all of us can understand exactly what it means. I just don't think that's possible.
And that falls back to, okay, you know, what's the definition of the or is? I mean, that falls back to, you know, any word, words by their nature are ambiguous. You know, so, okay, I grant you that. I'm asking for more than that. I'm asking about this specific instruction.
I think it's quite specific given the history of the of this instruction and the court's handling of it, Your Honor, because I do think there's a foundation dating back to 1894-95 of several different concepts with respect to what standard should be applied. And I was hoping to get to this a little later, but I have found that the Grotchen versus Rice case pretty well lays, to me at least, a very, very good roadmap of the things that this court should look at. And it was 1905 case where it talks about, one, preponderance of the evidence. It talks about that even though someone may prevail on having greater weight of evidence, that is not sufficient. And that's where the court applied, we think, they went back to Pelletier case about 10 years or so earlier, and said, we think there has to be something more than just mere weight as I understand it, that the jury has to be satisfied or convinced of the truth. To what standard they put that standard, to what degree they put the standard, that was to a reasonable certainty. And that has followed through throughout all the remaining cases by the Supreme Court. If it's all right, I'd like to read just a couple lines from Grotchen, Your Honor. The court said, this is again in 1905, what is meant by preponderance of the evidence? The manner in which the jury should proceed in solving disputed propositions on evidence and the degree of certainty to which they should arrive before rendering a verdict are elementary. The court goes on to say, there's no need for judges to make up new things or try and phrase it differently, because if they just follow what this court has said, they will be applying it correctly and fairly. And they go on to say that in the orderly way of determining the truth from evidence, the jury first consider the same and determine on which side of the dispute there is greater weight thereof, the more convincing indications as to where the truth lies. Then they next determine whether such greater indications are sufficiently convincing to satisfy them of the truth of the matter. This is the key to reasonable certainty, because that's the definition that the Supreme Court gave. I believe that phrase, that they next determine whether such greater indications are sufficiently convincing to satisfy them of the truth of the matter, and they say not beyond a reasonable doubt, or no degree of certainty in civil cases required, nor merely as to what the preponderance of the evidence tends to prove, where that degree of certainty leaves the truth of the matter possibly not more than suggested, meaning it's not enough for someone to come in and merely say, or put sufficient evidence to say, I have a little, or the old tipping the balance, I have a little weightier argument. The court has said that there must be something more.
But let me advance, Counselor. You indicate that's a 1905 case.
Yes.
In 1922, you had the Couch case, and that was discussed at some length in your writings. And in that case, the court didn't even give a burden of proof instruction. So, you know, I am not so taken with the 1905 case that says it's elementary to have both the burden of proof and a reasonable certainty, when in 1922 the judge just did a reasonable certainty, didn't even give a burden of proof instruction, and we said that was okay.
Yeah. Well, in Koch, Your Honor, the court said, with reference to each question, the jury were told that before they could return an affirmative answer, they must be satisfied to a reasonable certainty by a consideration of all the evidence that the fact inquired about existed.
Right,
so
but you can see there was no burden of proof instruction even given in the Couch case.
Well, I think what Couch said is this other instruction or charge to the jury fully satisfied
what we would normally say is the preponderance of evidence or the greater weight of the credible evidence.
Yes. But not only just the preponderance, and that's...
Counsel, if you'd stand in front of the microphone.
I'm sorry, thank you.
Record it, no problem.
It's not just the balancing, and I think, and I'll go back to Grotchen, and I don't know if you can understand my reading as well as when you look at the printed page, but I would strongly urge the court to review Grotchen, because I do think it gives this great layout of all this, but it's more than just the who gives more evidence or not, and that's why I think implicit in the burden of proof instruction there has to be some standard. I don't think some of the appendix jury instructions would be incompatible, I believe, with Wisconsin law, because historically this court has urged, we're not just talking about a little weightier here, we're talking about it's got to be weightier and it's got to be convincing to the jury that that's where the truth lies.
Do you object to the general verdict? The verdict form requires you to state whether you find the plaintiff or defendant. The burden, called the burden of proof, is on the plaintiff to satisfy you by the greater weight of the credible evidence that you find for the plaintiff. If you're not so satisfied, you must find for the defendant. It doesn't say anything about certainty.
That's true, Chief Justice. I frankly was scratching my head because in my 25 years of practicing law, I've never had a general verdict, so I'm a little bit unfamiliar with it. But I presume, without knowing and without, I tried to find an answer, but I presume that in a general verdict, when you find either for the plaintiff or the defendant, the court has already made some kind of universal finding that you can either find facts that are sufficient one way or the other, meaning there's an independent, either the parties have agreed that the facts are such, or it's not contested, such that the jury only needs to find, who do you believe? I think that's the best I could come up with on that analysis. I was unable to find anything that explained why the special verdict would have reasonable certainty and the general verdict did not.
Now, you keep saying that it's just not enough for the plaintiff to tip the scales, but I'm not so sure you're right about that. I mean, I don't want to get into a debate as to whether 52% or not is enough, or 55, or what's beyond a reasonable doubt, whether that's 98%, but there has to be a difference between the three standards. And I don't know why tipping it in favor of the plaintiff isn't good enough. If there's a greater weight of the credible evidence, even if it's 2 or 3% in my mind, I have to hold for the plaintiff.
Well, don't get me wrong, Chief Justice. I'm not saying that it should be any different than preponderance of the evidence. I think that's ingrained in our law. But, again, and I'll cite back to Grotch. They're saying you need something more than just merely a showing, that you might have a little weightier evidence if that evidence is not sufficiently convincing that that's the truth of the matter.
By the greater weight of the evidence is meant evidence which, when weighed against evidence opposed to it, has more convincing power. Do you accept that?
Yes, I think that's a standard definition.
I ask the same question as Justice Bradley asked, but I'm going to ask you differently. Namely, she asked you whether you thought that this instruction was confusing. I'm going to ask you, do you think the instruction can be improved?
Well,
it may be perfectly all right. Everything can be improved. It was good enough for you to win, but do you think it can be improved?
I'd like to say as an advocate, if it ain't fixed, don't broke it. Or don't, it ain't broken, don't fix it. And not much of an advocate at that, obviously, but I did, in anticipation that someone might ask that question, I did jot down some wordsmithing to myself, which I think retains both the character of the court's decisions over the years and I think addresses Judge Brown's problem. Give the court.
Good. Would you show it to other counsel, too?
I would start because in reviewing Judge Brown's concurring opinion, I looked very carefully to see whether he really took issue with the standard of reasonable certainty. And I didn't find that he really did. I think his main thrust, as stated by him, was I think there could be some confusion in the minds of the jury of lapping over between reasonable certainty and preponderance of the evidence. And to answer your question, Chief Justice, I started with the same first sentence as had been in the instruction. I then propounded, this burden is to satisfy you in your own mind to a reasonable certainty that the party having the burden of proof has presented credible evidence which is of greater weight than the evidence opposing it, such that you can determine that yes should be the answer. And I guess in my own attempts, Judge, take care of Judge Brown, who said you're not telling the jury that you have a mental aspect and then you have a weighing and balancing aspect.
Counsel, I'm surprised. My reading of Judge Brown's concurrence with regard to his taking exception to the term reasonable certainty is different than yours. I look at his first paragraph, the last sentence of his first paragraph. He says, I'm satisfied that using the term reasonable certainty in the instruction creates too high of a risk, etc. Then he quotes the instruction. Then the first sentence in his next paragraph, the term reasonable certainty is not defined for jurors, etc., etc., etc. I think he does take exception to the term reasonable certainty, and if I recall in his proper instruction, I might be wrong, he doesn't use that term. That's my recollection. That he does very much take exception. That's what his concurrence is all about.
I guess I was focusing, Justice Walsh Bradley, on page 8 of the slip opinion, which is point 8 of the appendix of plaintiff's brief, at paragraph 43, where he says, I will now discuss the Wisconsin Civil Jury Instructions Committee statement that the instruction accurately reflects the degree of certitude jurors must reach in answering verdict questions. But then if you go on for the next two pages, I don't think he ever says, I repute reasonable certainty or I disagree with it. I think what he actually is saying is, and it harkens back to what you read, that I think there's a chance that a juror might put into the preponderance of the evidence some belief that the plaintiff has to show that to a reasonable certainty.
Indeed, the very paragraph you just read, paragraph 43, he says the very real risk that their hearer will use the, quote, reasonable certainty language as the method by which the two sides are weighed. That phrase, I think, is the essence of this concern, as I read it. Maybe it's just a different interpretation, but I see him saying just as he says in paragraph 43 that I just read.
I want to make sure that I'm articulating my beliefs, or my analysis was that he didn't specifically say that reasonable certainty is a standard that shouldn't be applied, but rather in the context of this instruction, there's a chance that that standard might be incorporated into the aspect. That was my interpretation of his concern, and I think that's borne out by in his proposed jury instruction as well.
Counsel, I read your draft, and I'd like it, but now tell me why in the third line we could not eliminate the words in your own mind for reasonable certainty. Remember, proving we're not conceding this error, I'm not trying to get you into possession. The
burden is to satisfy you that the party having the burden of proof has presented credible evidence which is of greater weight than the evidence opposing it, such that you can determine that yes should be the answer. By greater weight of evidence, we mean evidence which, when weighed against evidence opposing it to it, has more convincing power. Credible evidence is evidence which is worthy of your belief. You have to guess what the answer should be after discussing all the evidence and the party having the burden of proof has not met the burden.
At least in my attempts to formulate the instruction, Chief Justice, I guess I was defending against Judge Brown's comments, and I thought that his comments were mostly directed at saying, and I think on the last few pages, that's what he's saying, that the jury is not told that, you know, that the person with the burden has to prove to them, so they have a mental state, what's in their mind, that the burden of proof, that the preponderance of the evidence has been satisfied by the party with the burden. So I felt that would retain the standard that has been used by this court for over 100 years. That this is the mental degree of certitude that you should have about tilting the balance. And that's the reason for my inclusion of that language.
Thank you.
Mr. Nelson, we heard from Mr. Stutz earlier that the studies and articles that you cite in your brief are flawed, that we shouldn't accept those because in one instance it was a Canadian study, and I think in another instance it excluded women. Do you have any response to that or any justification for the studies that you were citing us to?
You know, I really am not going to make any justification. I believe they were submitted to show that depending on the group that is being reviewed or interviewed or tested, what I was attempting to show that Kong's article in the New England Journal of Medicine should also be looked at a little bit differently than I believe what Alan Gessler in his article in Waddle had said, and frankly what Judge Brown had said, because a number of things. One, for instance, Kong dealt with medical professionals, not with the average juror. Two, there was a continuum of phraseology that may have greater application in medical. You know, is it probable? Is it certain? All the way down the line. But they were given a continuum. And even among those, there were different scales used. In fact, I believe in Kong's article itself, it said if you use a free choice scale of probability or they didn't use reasonable certainty. That was not one of the categories, but there's as much as a 12 percentage point change. So I guess our purpose was not to draw on any particular other study, but just to find other studies to show that it's really all over the board, that it's confusing whether you say probability, it may be confusing whether it's reasonable certainty, or whether it, as the court had used in other cases, if you are convinced in your own minds.
Supposed to someone else's mind.
Well, yeah, but
Mr. Nelson.
Yes.
It strikes me that this reasonable certainty phrase, the phrase reasonable certainty, goes to the degree to which the juror must be satisfied.
Yes, I agree.
And so what we've got here is an attempt to greater define for the juror the word satisfied. In other words, this burden is to satisfy you. In other words, your degree of satisfaction must be to a reasonable certainty. And I'm not sure, I'm not at all convinced that we need to further define the word satisfy, that we could simply stop very much along the lines of what the Chief Justice said to eliminate. But let's assume that this court, that's all prefatory to my real question. Let's assume that this court decides that we should either substitute the word probability for certainty or get rid of reasonable certainty altogether. Why should you prevail then? Why should we start that opinion with affirm rather than reverse? And let it go back for a new trial on the issue of liability.
Because, Your Honor, I believe this would be an appropriate case for what is called sunbursting or prospective overruling of a case. First of all, I don't believe the formulation that this court would come up with would be one that was proposed by a plaintiff in the trial court. With respect to sunbursting, Your Honor, I believe that part of the thought behind the sunbursting doctrine is to, in cases where the Supreme Court is concerned that the courts would have to relitigate cases already disposed of by litigation or settlement. We have been using, at least as far as I have seen, since 1972, this burden of proof instruction. And I believe for the administration of justice, it would not be prudent at this point to upset the apple cart as to cases that are in progress of litigation or have been litigated. I would particularly cite to the court Bilski versus Schultze at 16 Wisconsin 2nd Law, 1961, where the court held that I believe this was the change as far as comparative negligence in defining percentages. And the court there held we are not going to apply the Blackstonian doctrine of retroactivity in this case, and instead the new law would not, or the new common law would not apply if the judgment was based on old rules, has been entered, and no motion to vacate before this date, the date of the decision, or where verdicts have been rendered sufficient to dispose of case under prior rules, but where new rules would require a new trial, not required for other reasons. I think that second portion, I would suggest to the court, would make sense, because in all fairness to Judge Creel and to my clients, I think we were operating under not only the formulation of the Wisconsin Jury Instruction Committee, but the pronouncements of this court for over 100 years. And that's why I believe this court should affirm, and if the court believes that language should be changed, that the doctrine of sunbursting or prospective overruling be implemented here. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
counsel. I know you're going to respond to this, but what about if the court would look at this in a prospective manner, and what the opposing counsel said makes sense? Tried under reasonable certainty, that's been around for a few years, expressed by members of this court and yourself. Why would we want to send this back?
Well, Judge, there would be no incentive for a litigant to come before you without the benefit of having a turn over this particular verdict.
So this is kind of like a reward that we probably we agree, or
you cannot expect that with the considerable expense in the jury's jurisprudence presently, that anyone would come before you with the idea only that this would be set forth as a prospective application. We've, I believe, established that there was a prejudicial effect here by virtue of the fact that this was a close case, that we presented the evidence on causation, that our expert was the only one that presented an actual opinion on the causation of this injury, that we had two dissenting jurors to the response to the question of causation. And by the judge's comments that he felt that there was some merit to our particular presentation. In response to the suggestion that because we, you as a court may draft the instruction different than what was proposed to the trial judge, I would state that we were raising the issue and preserving the issue for you. And we were trying to move the trial judge just a little step on the path to making a jury instruction understandable. Obviously, you can make it fully understandable by what you do. And I would suggest that what was proposed by opposing counsel here, again, flies in the face of common experience. That is, again, they put the definitions after the description of the burden of proof. When you try to explain something to the common average person, you define terms first, and then you present the operative provision. Look at the tax statute, section 71.02 on income taxation. You define what adjusted gross income is first, and then you describe what the tax provision is.
Counsel, in a review of the cases, you can pick out a lot of things in the different cases to stand for whatever you're arguing. But some of the cases stand for the proposition that maybe in every burden of proof has two elements. Number one, the degree of certitude, and number two, the quantity of evidence. And that in this case, the to a reasonable certainty, which go to the degree of certitude. Now, some cases say that, some cases don't say that. Some cases, a holding is actually contrary to that. But let's say, again, let's say we look at those cases and say, here we have a degree of certitude and we have a quantity of evidence. The instruction is consistent with the law.
Judge, I believe that the trend in American jurisprudence is set forth in McCormick's. In McCormick's, they talk about there are two standards, the burden of producing evidence before the trial judge and the burden of persuasion. And they don't make have an additional standard in the burden of persuasion as a dual component, as you suggested.
Well, let me say this. Let me ask this. Is it your position that what I have just said with regard to two elements, the degree of certitude and the quantum of evidence, may be the existing law, but if it is, it should be changed to reflect the McCormick approach?
Yes, Judge. And again, it's a matter of clarity. We can't expect the jury to understand those two concepts by virtue of the 40-plus words in the sentence that opposing counsel just suggested.
Let me one step further. Is it that those two elements, which I just referenced, the degree of certitude and the quantum of evidence, that that is the law in the state of Wisconsin, but because it's confusing, it should be changed? Is that your position? What's your position?
We believe Alan Gessler's opinion on that, that that isn't the law. But should the court feel that it is the law, we would suggest that that be disapproved.
What about counsel moving it out of, over here? what about moving it out of the concept of reasonable certainty, which is the law, out of that section of the instruction which defines the burden of proof? Because the concept of reasonable certainty is not, in fact, the burden of proof. It is, as Justice Babbage noted, the degree to which the jury must be satisfied that the plaintiff has satisfied the burden of proof, which is preponderance of the evidence. So if that's the law, if the law is that the jury must be satisfied to a reasonable certainty that the plaintiff has met his burden of proof, in other words, we don't want juries guessing about whether the plaintiff has met his burden of proof. We don't want juries even saying the plaintiff has probably met his burden of proof. We want jurors who can say, before we will enter a verdict, that they are reasonably certain that the plaintiff has met his burden of proof. Does it solve the problem to restate the law and the instruction by confining the first and second paragraphs to the definition of preponderance of the evidence and putting the concept of reasonable certainty in the third paragraph, which discusses the concept of guesswork versus reasonable certainty?
May I answer the question, Chief Justice?
Yes, of course, Counsel.
Thank you. Yes, I agree wholeheartedly with you that we should get the mental element component out and we should put it into weight of the evidence during instruction. I agree with that.
Or even in the third paragraph of the burden of proof, which tells the jury
that they have to be satisfied to a reasonable certainty that the plaintiff has met the burden of proof as we have just defined it for you.
Yes, that would be better as well. But again, I think that we should define terms first before we expect a juror to understand what they have to do.
And the problem here is really the juxtaposition of that concept of reasonable certainty in the definition of the burden in the first and second paragraphs of the instruction.
Yes.
Thank you, Counsel. That concludes our argument.